Since the dawn of civilization, spies of every nation and culture have worked to infiltrate their adversaries and glean the information that will give their side the advantage. The stakes are sky high, the strategies varied and imaginative, and the ultimate sign of success is that no one ever even knew you were there. In each episode, we will explore the moral and ethical gray zones of espionage, where treachery and betrayal go hand in hand with cunning and courage. This is the Spycraft 101 podcast. Welcome to your clandestine classroom. This is episode number 139 of the Spycraft 101 podcast. Joining me today is Ricky O'Rall. Ricky is a former member of the Irish Republican Army. Since leaving the IRA, Ricky has worked as a peace advocate and has written several nonfiction books, as well as two novels about the Troubles. I invited Ricky onto the podcast after reading his newly published book, Steak Knife's Dirty War, the inside story of Scappaticci, the IRA's Nutting Squad, and the British spooks who ran the war. It's the story of Britain's greatest intelligence coup during the Troubles, the recruitment of Freddie Scappaticci, the man who ran the IRA's internal security unit. He vetted all the IRA recruits and hunted down informants within the ranks, all while reporting everything he saw, did, and learned to British intelligence. But before I dive into this story, I want to say a big thank you to everyone listening who is also supporting me on Patreon, including Connie T. and Andy H. Your monthly contributions there help me keep this podcast going week in and week out. As a way of thanking my patrons, I offer a lot of great freebies and promotions, including free and discounted books and products from the Spycraft 101 store. Patrons also get exclusive access to long-form articles of mine that aren't available anywhere else. If you haven't signed up for my Patreon yet, but you want to, just click the link in the show notes on whatever podcast platform you're listening to right now. Ricky, thank you for joining me. I'm really glad we have this chance to talk.
You're more than welcome, Justin. It's a pleasure to be here.
Terrific, terrific. I thought that I was somewhat familiar with this story before reading your book, but I truly had no idea just how profound was his reach and his impact on that entire conflict. So this, to me, is just like an almost unbelievable story, honestly.
Well, it is, by any stretch of the imagination. It is an unbelievable story. I mean, I knew Freddie Scappaticci. I didn't know him well, but I knew him. I met him. I first met him when we were both interned without trial in the early 1970s, and it was a nodding sort of a relationship. How are you? No more than that, thank God. No one would have suspected in the IRA that Freddie Scappaticci had been turned by the British and was actually involved to the extent that he was in killing IRA people and overseeing the killing of IRA people and reporting everything to the British. It was a shock that the system in terms of the IRA could barely handle.
I have to imagine it really is amazing stuff. So you did know him a little bit in the early years, is that right? But you didn't see him for quite some time after that?
Oh, I've seen him all right. I mean, I knew him from internment, but I would have seen him about the place. You know, Freddie was one of those guys who would have commanded a room. He was a very foreboding character, I would say, more than anything. Sulky, a sort of guy, when everyone else was out in the pub getting drunk, Freddie would have been standing at the end of the bar with the one pint all night, one pint of beer all night, watching everyone and watching everybody. And he had a presence, a menacing presence about him. So you wouldn't have missed him. You'd have seen him about the place. Plus, he was involved at the higher level of the Republican movement. So again, he would have had access to a lot of IRA activity.
Hmm. Okay. Amazing. So I know that you've written several books prior to this. What was it that led you to dedicate make your next book about Freddie anyway? Was it new information coming to light or just inspiration struck or something else?
It came out of the blue. I had just finished a novel. I had committed myself to do no more factual proofs. I prefer to write novels. They're less controversial, to say the least. And you, right. And they're your own creation, so you can literally go wherever you want in your mind with them. So I had just finished a book called Gurion's Gold, and my publisher a guy called Conor Graham from Merriam Press and I were met in December 3 years ago. He said to me, what are you doing now? And I had it in my head to write another novel. And he said to me, it was actually his idea, what about a book on steak knife? And I was reluctant to go down that road because I knew it would be controversial. And controversy over here means that if you're anyway controversial, you get ostracized and you get blacklisted and nobody talks to you and all of that stuff. I knew that would be probably a consequence of it. But I decided, is it the right thing to do? Yes, it is. Never mind being ostracized and all everything else. So I agreed to write the book. And that's really how it came about. There was no great revelation about Canova or anything else. I literally wrote the book and I knew very little about Freddy Scapatici. I wasn't too long finding out about him, but initially I knew very, very little about him.
Okay, yeah, I bet this was quite a journey of discovery in that case.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the first thing I had to do was to say, who is he? Now, let's take away the IRA stuff. What type of a person is Freddy Scapatici? Where did he live? What's his social history? Who were his confederates when he was growing up? I had to find all that out. And how was he viewed by his confederates? So I had to go and I interviewed a lot of people. He grew up in the markets area of Belfast. And I had to go, the first thing I had to do, and then I concentrated on this first, was to find out who he was. And I talked to neighbours, I talked to people who knew him very well, and I got the gist of the guy, intemperate, bad, punchy guy, very, very punchy. He'd have thrown a punch at you as quick as look at you. He was a wife beater. I mean, I'm not going to mince my words. One lady, actually two, a lady and a man who lived in the same street as him said he murdered his wife. So he was a wife beater. He was punchy. His favourite trick was to put a brick in a sack and bash someone over the head with it if they crossed him. And so this is the type of guy that I was beginning to see. That was the type of guy who was beginning to emerge. And I mean, no matter where I looked, a couple of guys said in defence of him that he was very loyal. If you were his friend and you were in trouble, he'd have been there for you. But if you crossed him, you were in serious trouble. So he was very intemperate, very hot-headed, wife-beating guy who was just totally unsavory. That's the only way. I could doll him up as somebody who was very, very good with people. He wasn't. He was a horrible wee person.
Oh, man. Oh, I see. So what was it that led him into the IRA as a young man then? Was it friend connections or was he actively sought out or something like that?
No, in 1969, the north of Ireland, Belfast area, except in Northern Ireland, people call it different. Well, over here, terminology is important. It's either the north of Ireland or it's Northern Ireland, whichever one you choose. There was a major eruption and the two communities clashed. Well, they didn't really clash. It was basically the Catholic community was under huge siege. Whole streets were being burned by unionists, and the unionists were being protected by the then police force, the RUC. And so waves were running up the street with kids, and behind them, their houses were on fire. As I say, whole streets were burned, and there was huge civil unrest. And the British Army came in on the 15th of August, 1969, and sort of held the middle ground. But in the meantime, the Nationalist areas, vigilante groups were established. The Catholic areas were defenceless. The idea was that the vigilantes would organize and have petrol bombs, and if there was any more assaults on the Nationalist areas, they would defend them, and Scapatici became a vigilante. But then there was major friction within the IRA. The IRA, before the Troubles in Belfast, really didn't exist. There would have been 6 or 7, 8 guys who viewed themselves as IRA men. There's no guns. Well, whatever guns they had, maybe a couple of handguns. But that was about it. They had no real weaponry at all. And hence, that's why it was so easy for the unionists, etc., to burn the Catholic area, the old Catholic areas and streets. So more militant people came into the Republican movement, people who had been around from the 1940s and had been pushed out. They came back and they formed the Provisional IRA, and Scapatici joined the IRA from the outset. That's the Provisional IRA. And that was the start of his career. That was in 1970, December 1970. And that was the start of his career as an IRA man.
So I know that, not to jump ahead too far, but I know he winds up in the ISU. So what was his path into the ISU? Because that's clearly like a position of great trust within the organization.
Well, his never made his nasty ways. His leadership qualities, and he did have leadership qualities, were recognized almost immediately. And within no time at all, he was an OC of a company, of a very important company, IRA, company in Belfast. OC being officer commanding, company being the structure of the area. So he was the number one in one of the most important areas in Belfast. And then he was interned twice. He actually spent 4 years in jail, interned without trial. And when he got out, he sort of drifted for a while. And then the decision was taken to form this unit, this internal security unit. And Scapatici, with his pedigree, and he did have a very strong Republican pedigree. No one can take that away from him, and I certainly wouldn't try to. He was known to be intelligent. On top of everything else, he was no fool. He had a degree of intelligence about him. So, as a result of that, there he was seen as a natural candidate for this internal security unit. And he joined it, and he was adjutant on it. That means he was number two. OC is number one, and an adjutant is number two. So they formed this unit. The purpose of the unit was to hunt out informers and British agents within the IRA and dispatch them accordingly. That means shoot them dead. That was the initial remit of this unit. And Scapatici was right in the heart of it, right from the word go.
So how big was this unit? Like, how effective were they? Was he doing a good job initially as far as the IRA was concerned?
Well, this unit, there'd have been maybe about no more than about 15 people in it at any one time. And they were 15 people who had been through the mill. They had been in prison. They had been through prison. They had been through police interrogations, hard police interrogations. They knew the score. They'd been around the block. And that was really why they were picked. Their success was gauged by how many informers they caught and how many informers ended up shot dead. That was basically the criteria by which they were judged. And they were quite good at it. I mean, people started to be found shot dead in country roads in Fermanagh and Tyrone, Armagh, South Armagh, etc., and in Belfast as well. So they were quite good at it. Scapatici was at the heart of it. He was by far and away the most persuasive interrogator in the whole unit. This unit used whatever means they deemed necessary to break people, whether that be torture. Very rarely did they break people by persuasion, because there was an understanding that once a person was broke, they made a verbal admission into a recording device, and that was really the death knell for them. Mm-hmm. But they tortured people, and they got people to confess to being agents or informers. Sometimes people who weren't just did it to end the beatings. And once you did that, you'd signed your own death warrant. I mean, within hours, you were shot dead. And Scapatici was one of the most persuasive guys. He would have said, this can all stop. All you have to do is tell the truth. What is the truth? Truth is, you're an informer. You're an informer, aren't you? You are an informer. And eventually the person would say yes. And once they said yes, and, you know, that was really it over for them.
Okay, were there any cases where they would question somebody and release them, like find that they were not an informant, or was it essentially a death sentence just to be picked up by the ISU to begin with?
No. People were released. Some people couldn't be broken. In my book, there's an interview with a guy who was told to be at a car park in Dundalk. That's in County Louth. And he went to the car park, and it was way over off the beaten track. He was put into a sleeping bag, thrown under the boot of a car, and driven down to the Midlands, down to Roscommon in Ireland, brought into a deserted farm shed, and taken out of the boot, and he was lifted above head high and dropped on the concrete, lifted above head high, dropped on the concrete again and again and again. And they used him as a human ice tray, and they beat him black and blue for 3 days. And this guy I said to him, did you ever even think of signing? And he says, I didn't. He says, one, because he knew that once I signed, it was signing my own death warrant. And two, he says, this is a strong wee guy. I know this guy is as strong as a bull. He says, I wasn't a tout. I wasn't an informer. I wasn't an agent. And I wasn't going to admit it. They would have had to kill me. Right? And I still wouldn't have done it. Well, after 3 days, they had no alternative but to let him go because he didn't say. Had he signed, or had he spoken into that recording and told them that he was an agent, he would have been found dead. Shot dead.
My gosh. It's incredible he was able to endure all of that. Was he kind of unassailable after that? Did no one ever question him again at that point?
Oh, he opened up. He opened up the whole thing. This guy was very, very well got in Republican circles. He wasn't just someone from the street. He went to a leading Republican called Brenton Hughes, also known as the Dark. And the Dark had been just released from prison. And he was on the IRA General Headquarters staff. He was also on the IRA Army Council. That's the 7-man council that runs the whole IRA. And he told him what happened to him, and Brandon was absolutely infuriated. And he instigated an IRA court of inquiry against two of the men who had tortured this chap. And they were dismissed with ignominy from the IRA. So there was consequences to what they did to this lad. But you know, I'm not so sure. That didn't stop it. It went on again after that there. Brendan sort of fell out of favor with the leadership because he was causing waves that they didn't like. They were quite happy to let the Internal Security Unit, also known as the Nutting Squad, because people who crossed them ended up getting nutted, which is not as your an Irish thing for head. You got a bullet in the back of the head, so therefore you were not. People who crossed the Nutting Squad invariably ended up being found dead. So Brendan was a superior rank to any of them, but he ended up, I met him one day down his flat, he had a flat in Divis Flats, and we were talking about this, and he said to me, Rick, I'm getting out of Belfast. And I says, why? He says, because I'm going to get shot dead. And I says, and I assumed that it was loyalist, because he would have been he was a former brigade OC, a former top man in Belfast. He was very, very famous. He says, no, it won't be loyalists that kill me. It'll be Republicans. It'll be people that's walking this road. And I thought, whoa. And he did get out. He went down to Dublin to live for a while. When he was away, it all started up again. And the two boys who had been dismissed with ignominy came right back into play again.
Wow. Amazing. After everything he went through, it still wasn't over for him, unfortunately.
He was only out after doing something like 14 years in prison.
My gosh.
And it certainly wasn't over for him, no, by a long stretch.
Mm-hmm. So how many people are known to have been killed by the Nutting Squad over the course of its existence?
Well, I counted it up. There's a book called Lost Lives in which everyone who was killed in the troubles, their stories are counted. And I counted up between 1978, roughly, when the Internal Security Unit was set up, and 1984, when it was disbanded, there was 35 people shot dead. Now, Canova was investigating Scapatici, steak knife, for 17 killings, murders. So, this was something that was ongoing over all that time. And that's just killings. There was people getting kneecapped, like shot in the legs. There was people getting punishment beatings. People, you know, all of that came into play with these guys.
Hmm. So he personally killed about half of the suspected informants that were taken by the ISU.
No, you can't say that. He didn't personally kill them. He may have killed one or two, and he's actually boasted about it in the past. But he would have been the person. He and two or three guys around him would have been the adjudicators. They would have been the people who would have recommended to the IRA Army Council that John Smith has admitted to being an agent, and we recommend that he be shot dead. And that would have been enough. An IRA volunteer, usually not even associated with the Nutting Squad, would have been brought in to carry out the execution.
Oh, wow. Okay. Interesting.
He'd have just been told someone has to be shot dead, and it's an order. You have to shoot him. So he would have obeyed the order.
That's surprising. I would assume that they would do it themselves, but that's interesting.
No.
Ricky, obviously no one knows better than Freddie what happens to the informants and the suspected informants, but he became one himself. So how in the world did that happen? Like, how could they get to him of all people, and how could he go along with it?
Well, Justin, that's the million-dollar question. And everyone has had a poke at trying to answer that, and nobody has come up with a hard and fast reason for him going to the British. There's all sorts of theories. One is that he was just a walk-in, that he was disenchanted with the IRA, and that he decided to work for the other side, and he just walked into a police station and says, "I want to work for security forces." That's very tenuous, to say the least. Another one was he was involved in a tax scam, and there was quite a bit of money involved in it, and he was involved in it, and there was a possibility that he would have got 8 years in prison. He was certainly arrested for it, and that's the reason why he turned. That's a possibility. Another one was that, and this is one that I've heard, and I never put a great deal of credence in it, but lately it's starting to get a bit of traction, that he was involved with underage sexual activity.
Okay.
Now, I have seen no evidence of that, to be honest, and what you've done that. In 2018, he was actually charged with having bestial pornography on his computer. Was given a sentence for it. Now, he wasn't a prison sentence, but he was certainly he pleaded guilty to it. But I see no evidence that he was involved in activity with kids. So nobody really knows why he was turned. People have theories, but that's as far as it goes.
Okay. I see. Or is it known at least approximately when he was turned and who he reported to, that sort of thing?
He was turned between 1977, late 77, 78. Talk is that he was turned by a British Army intelligence officer. I know his name, and it's actually in my book, but I'm not too sure we should say it here. It doesn't really matter in any way. But that's the guy that's alleged to have turned him, if he was turned by him at all. Again, you don't know. This British Army officer has said publicly, and it's in a book that he turned him. But I mean, you just don't know. I mean, a lot of this stuff in relation to Scapatici, you just need to be careful. You don't rush into hard and fast positions because it could change very, very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's so much that's not known. I do know who you're referring to. I know it's in your book, and it's been in another book as well. I actually reached out to that individual over a year ago to ask him for an interview, and he never responded, which, you know, I guess I can't be too surprised by that. That happens pretty often with me, but I was able to find some contact information for him, and I have read a little bit about his story. That would have been a very interesting discussion, I'm sure, but he probably won't ever speak out.
I tried to get him as well, and he didn't. I actually had a friend who's a journalist who went over and met him in London. Had a coffee with him, and she said to him, "Ricky's writing this book," and he knew about it. And she says, "He would like to interview you," and he started laughing. And he says, "I'm meeting the MI5 after this." He says, "I was meeting them before, I was meeting you anyway." He says, "But if I was to tell them Ricky Raw was not an interview with me and be trying to recruit him. I says, good luck with that one. You may stay deep in your pockets, boys.
Wow. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, that's so unfortunate that he won't open up a little bit. He would certainly be able to shed a lot of light on this to someone, anyway.
Well, he's a writer, Justin. So I suspect that somewhere along the line, we'll see a book from him.
I would read that book. Definitely. I hope that does happen, certainly.
So would I.
Was Freddie, like, what was the benefit to him? Is that known? Like, was he being paid large sums of money for the information he provided or getting revenge on enemies within the IRA? Anything like that?
He's getting £80,000 a year, according to the guy that we're talking about. Let's call him Jonesy, for want of a better word. Right? According to Jonesy, he was getting £80,000 a year. £80,000 back in the 70s, related to today, is almost 270,000 quid in around that figure. So he was getting very good money. But Freddie was making good money too. He was a builder. And he went to work every day. He seemed to come with me. Yeah, his life was well ordered. He went to work every day. So he wasn't stuck for money. And, you know, the talk was that money was kept for him. I spoke to a former member of the British Army, the guy who actually outed him in the first place. And he told me that the money was put in an account for him in Malta. And when his IRA days finished, he had over £1 million on it. Now, whether there's any merit in that, I don't know, but that's what was said.
Yeah, that is a huge sum. A lot of people have been paid less than that for similar activity, so it really shows his value to the Brits anyway. But like you said, he had his own company, his own construction company, didn't he? I mean, he was a successful guy.
He wasn't stuck for money. He was the sort of guy who was quite innovative in terms of garnering a living. He did jobs here, there, and everywhere. He was a bricklayer by trade, and he had brickies working for him. So, I mean, as you say, he was also doing the tax fraud thing, which was enormous. You mean you're talking thousands and thousands, potentially thousands and thousands and thousands of pounds a week?
Yeah, he's got a lot of stuff going on at the same time, it seems. So, and that brings me kind of to my next question, Ricky, is how was he able to meet with and communicate with British intelligence without ever arousing suspicion for so many years?
Well, I've only one record of him meeting British intelligence. I spoke to a lady who lived around the corner from him, and way back in 1979, she was working in a local hotel called the Culloden Hotel. It's down in Hollywood. Hollywood's about 5 or 6 miles outside Belfast. But she was on the breakfast run, which meant that she had to be in work at 5 o'clock or something in the morning. So she's walking through the hotel car park, and she spots Freddie talking to these two guys, one with long hair and hippie tape guys. He seen her, and he turned his head away quickly. Now, they know each other, you know. They know each other because they see each other every day and they talk to each other. And she never said nothing. And she went back to her husband. Her husband was an IRA volunteer. And she said to him, I seen Freddie Scapatici, 5 o'clock in the morning, in a car park, talking to two suspicious guys. And she says, I would bet my bottom dollar there were two British intelligence guys that looked like soldiers. And the guy just laughed her off. But she was right. She was absolutely right, because in 1983, Freddie met journalists in the same hotel, the Culloden Hotel, and he was very reluctant to go there. And the first thing he said to them, this is a very strange place to meet, because you never know who you're going to run into.
Wow.
You run into the girl, you know, all those years previous.
Before we go on, I want to let you all know about a new educational tool you're not going to want to miss. It's the Gray Man Briefing Classified. By now, I think I know my listeners pretty well, and take it from me, this briefing is exactly the news and educational reference source that you've been looking for. You'll get breaking news updates from all over the world on topics including planned protests and riots, low-intensity conflicts, natural disaster alerts, cyber attacks, supply chain disruptions, and more. You'll also get access to articles that help you build your own skills, including urban survival, home security, counter-surveillance, escape and evasion techniques, and more. And this is much more than just a newsletter in your inbox. Joining the Gray Man Briefing Classified also includes invitation-only channels on the Telegram and Signal apps for convenient real-time updates. The newsletter subscription is normally $5 per month, but if you use the code GBCSpycraft, you can save 20% each month for the life of your subscription. I'm already a member myself and have been reading and learning a lot since I first subscribed. Look it up yourself at graymanbriefing.com. That's gray with an A, graymanbriefing.com. And use the discount code GBCSpycraft to save 20% right from the start.
You know, so that's the only recollection. That's the only time that I was ever told that how he met his handlers, where he met them, or nothing like that. That's all Walter Mitty stuff. You'd never find that out.
Yeah, understandable. Okay, so I guess one of the other big questions besides how he was turned is, while he is picking up and interrogating and killing these other informants, the British intelligence must have known that they were losing some of their lower level people to Freddy, right? Like, I mean, were they making the willful decision to sacrifice some of their people in the organization in order to protect Freddy, or was there something else going on there?
Oh, no. Freddy was very important to them. And they were, some of the people who were killed were genuine informers. A lot of them weren't. A lot of them were volunteers who were absolutely clean in terms of having been traitors. And for whatever reason, they usually torture. They spoke into that recording device and therefore signed their own death warrant. And mm-hmm. But the British knew all along. Well, the one thing that comes from Canova, and I said this in my book, Stake My Study War, I said this, and this was revolutionary at the time, although it was only released 5 months ago. I remember at the time people were saying, they're not going to say that. All I says, I'm telling you they are. I was speaking to people who were close to the Canova team, and the Canova team was making no secret about the fact that they had found out that the British intelligence had crossed the line, that they knew people were going to be murdered, and they had a choice, either step in and prevent those murders by arresting those who were planning it and save the person's life, or let the murder go ahead. If the rationale behind either both sides is, if they step in, they run the risk of losing Freddy. And there's two or three other guys in that internal security unit who have a very suspicious pedigree, whom people are now saying were also turned.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Run the risk of exposing all these guys, having this unit do down, or let the murder go ahead. And then that's don't forget, as I said at the start, this unit was gauged on how many people. The results was how many informers did they find and kill. So invariably, they let the people get killed, right? And this was what I was being told. And the body that left them being killed was a body called the Tasking and Coordinating Group. They were a group made up of RUC Special Branch, Royal Ulster Constabulary Special Branch, MI5, and an army intelligence group called the Military Reaction Force. They were the ones that was running Freddy and running most of the agents, along with Special Branch. And this group made the decisions on everything. All intelligence went through them, and all actions, if they were going to ambush an IRA unit, for example, in Fermanagh, South Tyrone, or wherever, or across MacLean, they were the guys who said go, right? And in this case, they said, don't go, right? When the IRA was going to kill people, they said, don't go, stay back, let the murder go ahead, keep our people in place. And that's what I had been told. And I put that in the book, and there was a miniature sort of eruption because it was so incendiary. And thankfully, Canova and John Boucher didn't allow themselves to be pressurized into withdrawing from that position. They were very, very strong on it in their report.
Hmm. Yeah, I know that you've mentioned Canova several times, and I wanted to cover that towards the end of the episode, but that's the big investigation into Scappaticci that's been going on for a number of years now, correct? And they just published an interim report a few days ago?
6 years.
6 years.
6 years it's been going on. It cost, I think it was £38 million. And they published their report on Friday. It's been absolutely wall-to-wall, had wall-to-wall coverage over here and in the international news from it was released. And as I say, the guy who headed it up was a guy called John Boucher. He was a former chief constable of Bedfordshire Police in England. And that's what gives it a degree of authenticity. And his number two was also a Scottish chief, former chief constable as well. So it wasn't as if this was something that could be novelled, right? Hmm. It wasn't. And they came out with very, very, very strong positions. They said, I'll just read something that Boucher said, that this was a conflict in the north where people operated off the books and the agents did stuff that should never have been allowed to happen. And we as security forces knew that those agents were committing murders. We knew full well that people were going to be tortured. We knew full well when people were being killed, who was responsible, and we didn't apply the rule of law. That's what Boucher said. And those words were absolutely inflammatory. Not just inflammatory, they demonstrated that the rule of law didn't apply here, that the police were capable of facilitating the IRA in the murder of citizens. Because that's exactly what happened here. Mm-hmm. And there are cases being taken now, more or less saying that the police conspired with the IRA to murder individuals.
My gosh, that's incredible. You're right that I'm used to these government reports of this nature. They turn into damage control or spin control or something like that for everyone involved. And that certainly does not sound the case from that one passage that you just read.
No, it's incredible. And the lawyer who represents most of the families is a chap called Kevin Winters from KRW Law. And he said, they're taking all sorts of cases. He says, this is a quote from him. These are just two quotes I'm giving you, Justin, because they're so important. He said, the staggering takeaway message is that the state could have and should have intervened to save lives. That this hasn't happened is legally and morally reprehensible. We are left with the horrendous conclusion and takeaway message that both the state and the IRA were co-conspirators in the murders of some of its citizens. I mean, that is an awful indictment of any police force anywhere in the world. I mean, that's like something in Chile, in Pinochet's days.
Mm-hmm.
Here it is in a democracy in Western Europe.
Yeah, calling the state and the IRA co-conspirators. That's incredible language there, incredible.
Well, that's what he said. I mean, that's what Kevin Winter said, and I thought it was very strong, tell you the truth. And I don't disagree with a word of it.
Mm-hmm. So, Ricky, was there anything, any factual information in the report that was surprising to you? Anything new that comes to light? Or is it the conclusions that are so strong, in your opinion?
Well, it's the conclusions of the report itself. There's a lot of procedural stuff in it. But this is only an interim report. There's a full report. I think there's a million words in it. That's coming out very, very, I think it's in May. And what Boucher is actually doing is that Boucher has went to families, has went to some of the families, it's went to all of the families that were involved in this. And he has told them individually what happened, their loved ones, where their loved ones were picked up. He named the names of the IRA people who picked them up, who questioned them. Right. He also told quite a few of them. I don't know how much what the number is. I know of at least, I've heard of three cases where Scappaticci and not just him, others. I mean, Boucher has said there's others in the internal security who phoned up their handlers and told them, this guy is going to be not shot dead. You know, I'm making you aware of it. And it went right up the lane to, as I say, this tasking and coordinating group, this overarching group of intelligence, police intelligence officers, and they let those murders go ahead. And that's what Boucher has told the families. He has given them the A to Z of their family members' execution. Mm-hmm. And they have found that to be very sort of cathartic, you know?
Sure.
I initially thought that it was going to be a whitewash. It isn't a whitewash. I think Boucher has been very honorable from the start to finish.
Fascinating. That's a rare case indeed, but I'm glad to hear that. If I'm not mistaken, Ricky, Scappaticci's name does not actually appear in the interim report, right? There's references to Steak Knife, but not to Scappaticci. Is that correct?
That's right. The Scappaticci, that's one of the contentious things that's in the report. Everybody knows Scappaticci. I mean, Boucher's not denying it, but he's not confirming it either because legally he's not allowed to. He's not allowed. There's a thing called no NCMB. No claim, no blame, no blame. That's British Army policy. They don't identify agents. They don't identify assets. So it's impossible for Boucher to identify Steak Knife and Scappaticci as one and the same person. But there's absolutely nobody under any illusions that they are one and the same. That's beyond dispute.
Right. So on that note, when did it become known that Freddie had become an informant for British intelligence?
Well, it became known roughly about 1999. There was a guy from the Force Reaction Unit. He had been in the Force Reaction Unit, and he had left the army, and he was very disturbed about what he knew about the activities of British intelligence and how they were recruiting people. And he was the handler of a guy from Derry. I forget his name right now. And he was very disturbed. Anyway, to cut a long story short, he was very disturbed. Frank Haggerty is the name of the guy. And he was his handler. He was very disturbed about it. And he was very disturbed about Scappaticci and the way Scappaticci had been allowed to be so comprehensively involved in murder and how his whole hands were soaked in blood. And this was a guy of conscience. And he told a journalist, he told Liam Clark about it, and one thing led to another, and then it sort of drifted in the ether. And then in 2003, papers got an inkling that it was Scappaticci, and they published it. They published his name. He became the center of attention, but he tried to brazen it out. He tried to what we call brassneck it out. He tried to say, "I'm not Steak Knife." He went on the media and he says, "You tell the families to come to me, and I look them in the eye, and I'll tell them I wasn't responsible for the deaths of their loved ones." And he was a selfish little shit, for want of a better word. It was all about him. Right? He didn't care about the families. It was all about him being allowed to stay in Belfast, right, and live his life. And he was getting away with it because Sinn Féin, the local Republicans, Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness and others all went in behind him and says, "This is an honourable man. This man isn't an informer. He is an honourable man. He's been set up by British security services," right? And they all knew that this boy was bad. They all knew he was wrong because they dumped him out of the IRA in 1980 and wouldn't let him back into the Knuckle Squad. They all knew. But he was determined to go nowhere until a lady called Sylvia Jones, she was a journalist, and she had worked with a television crew who shot a series called The Cook Report. This was a report that went around the UK and challenged people who may have been involved in some degree of criminality or IRA stuff or whatever. And they were involved. They were doing a program on Martin McGuinness. Martin McGuinness, as you may well know, was one of the leading Republicans, was until his death 30 years ago. And they were doing a program on his involvement in the IRA, and this lady, Sylvia Coote, was part of the programming team. And they'd finished, and then she got a communication from her producer in Birmingham to say that it was a guy who wanted to meet her. So she met him along with two or three others from the program, and it was Freddie Scapatici. And during the conversation, he admitted that he'd been in the IRA, that he'd been close to Martin McGuinness, that Martin McGuinness, according to him, was a monster. And he went into all sorts of detail about the IRA that wasn't really known, about the English department, and that's all stuff that was very, 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 should have been secretive. And they were going to run with it, and then Royal Ulster Constabulary Special Branch got the wind of it, and they persuaded them not to publish, not to go ahead with the interview, because A, it would have put Scapatici in danger, and B, it would have put other agents in danger. So they held it back. But 10 years later, in 2003, when the Scapatici stuff came out, and Scapatici was the man, this girl said, "I've had enough of this," and she published it. She published the interview with Scapatici, and she put it on the internet. There was no comment. Everybody knew his name, right? Everybody knew what he sounded like. And everyone knew, everyone in Belfast knew, this was Scap. You couldn't deny it. He's very distinctive. So the next day, he got the boat, he got the plane, whatever, and away he went into exile.
Amazing. So this was 2003 that everybody knew, and I know that he lived for another 20 years after that, and to me that's a little bit surprising. Was there ever any chance that people were going to come for him physically, you think?
No, there's no evidence whatsoever that the IRA ever set up a unit or set up any sort of team to go after him. It seems that they were quite happy that he was gone, that he was off say, that he was no longer a presence. And they sort of hoped that the Freddie Scapatici episode would drift into the ether and we'd never hear of him again. And what you have to understand was Scapatici was so senior in the IRA, and he was held in such high esteem, and he was held in such fear that were he to have been outed by the IRA, by rights he should have been knotted. He should have been shot dead by IRA criteria. He was a prime candidate to be shot dead. And they knew, they had a good idea that this boy was playing for the other team. But they never brought him in. They never tortured him. They never really tried to break him. They let him live in Belfast, as I say, until this true soldier had a bit of conscience. And in fairness, I spoke to the guy, and I found him very honourable, and no doubt about his honour. The problem that they had was, if they had a shot Scapatici, it would have had massive implications, because people would have said, well, if Scapatici's wrong, if Scapatici's on a bottom, if he's playing, if he's a tout, who isn't a tout? Who else in the leadership are touts? So that's the danger that they faced with Scapatici. It was easier for them to let him go away to England, let him hide up in some hidey hole in the back hills of Dakota or wherever, right? Just as long as we don't see him, and as long as he's not in the news over here.
Amazing stuff. And I know that his name was ruined after that, of course, but he still got away with his life and his money and his freedom, essentially, it sounds like. So he made out about as well as he could have under those circumstances, is my thinking.
Well, he got out of Dodge with his saddlebags full of gold, didn't he?
Right. Yeah, he sure did.
You know, so he was he wasn't a happy man. He was a very, very sad man. He always reminded me, funny enough, you remember the photo of Osama bin Laden in a room with a blanket around him, and he's holding the remote control and he's looking at the television? I don't know if you've seen that, but that was an image of Osama bin Laden. Freddie struck me like that, although the difference between him and bin Laden was that Freddie had a silver Mercedes. But he was very lonely. His family didn't go with him. His family were beautiful. His whole kids and all are beautiful people. And they're so embarrassed with this. And his mother was a saint. They say she was a saint. And so was his wife. Very religious people. Very sort of placid people, you know. Real gentle folk. And they had this monster amongst them. And he didn't give a shit about nobody. The only person he ever cared about in his whole life was himself. And he was just destructive to everyone and everyone who knew him, whether it was family or whether it was friends. It didn't matter. And he lived a life of loneliness. His wife, funny enough, died in, I think it was 2018. And she used to go over and see him every 2 or 3 weeks. You know, but other than that, he was sick. He had strokes and stuff. He was mentally a tortured soul. And all his money and all, it was no good to him. He had nobody to spend it on.
Oh, man. Yeah, so he's having to live with the consequences of his actions in some ways. And that is really unfortunate about his family, who apparently didn't, you know, do anything wrong. He just passed away last year, I believe. What, didn't he, in 2023?
He did, yeah. Yeah, last May.
So it was just natural causes, like died alone, something like that?
Well, see, that we don't know, Justin. Nobody knows. Nobody to this day knows how he died. I think Boucher said that he was cremated. And that's very... It was MI5 that handled his whole... You'd be tempted to say that handled his death, right?
Mm-hmm.
That he ate something he shouldn't have had, or there was something on his food. But his death was very fortunate, because with his death, a large evidential sort of ledger was removed from Canova, which meant that no one could be charged.
Oh, wow.
So his death was, from a point of view, from a security force point of view, from a point of view of being able to bring charges against individuals, and you're talking principally because of, about the security forces, because the IRA people have been about for 30, 40 years, and it's not as if it's not known who shot who and who was in the nothing squad. Everybody knows it. But point of the matter is, Scapatici had the potential, worry to have been in a witness box, to have revealed who his handler was, what information he passed up the lane, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But as we now know, he never saw the inside of a court. When it came to it, 6-7 months before all this came out, he died in mysterious circumstances. Now, Boucher says he died of natural causes, so you have to take his word for it. But even to this day, we don't know what those natural causes were.
Right. And the cremation means he's not going to be exhumed at any point in the future or anything like that either.
There's going to be no DNA.
Right.
There's nothing left.
It's a gift-wrapped death in that case.
Lovely.
You could look at it that way.
It couldn't happen any better. If you wanted to eradicate a source of embarrassment, stick them in a hot oven there, but with dust.
Wow. What a story. I'll tell you what a tragic character he was too, and the damage that he did to everyone around him from very, very early years on. That's very unfortunate.
Well, he was just one of those guys in life. He was a bit like Sammy Gravano, Sammy the Bull. He was that type of a person, you know mm-hmm. roughly the same type of gruff, nasty type. I hope Sammy doesn't hear that, comes after me. But he was a nasty bit of work.
Yeah, he certainly was. Unbelievable. Well, this is an incredible story, Ricky. I'm really glad that you were able to document it so well even before the report came out, because it's really great to read. It was great to read your book and realize after I read the Canova report, that you had pretty much nailed a lot of exactly what it was going to find to begin with, because you were so dialed in with the research and everything. So that was very cool, and really credits your own research and your hard effort long before that report was published.
Thanks so much, Justin. It was very gratified that the report was what it said it would be. And I was gratified that Boucher lived up to what he had told the guys who were informing me of his report. And I was glad he lived up to it. I need the balls to stand up and say what he had found out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely agree. So now that your book is published and now that the Canova report is out, what are you working on now? Do you have another book on the way?
I have a novel. It's got nothing whatsoever to do with Ireland. It's all to do with London. But I have a novel, myself and my daughter have written it, and we're just finishing it off to send it to my agent in London, and we're hoping to have it out next year.
Oh, fantastic. Is there anything you can tell us about it right now, or do you want to keep it under wraps until it's closer to publication?
It's a cop thing. It's a story about a guy called the Witchfinder General. Witchfinder General was a historical character in the time of Oliver Cromwell in the English Civil War. And he went around southern England hanging and burning witches, as he seen it. And he done about 240 of them in. And the book is really a copycat, turns up in London in 2024. Right, and starts killing people.
Wow, okay, that sounds fascinating.
Well, I enjoyed writing it, and so did my daughter. It was a relief from writing Steak Knife's Dirty War. You know, it's so different. You can sit at the computer, and you can just go wherever you want. It's your world.
Yeah, that must be great. I'm sure a nice change of pace, even though you're still there writing and getting things out on paper, which is a good feeling always.
Well, you're not in this world, put it like that. You're in a totally different stratosphere.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, Ricky, do you have a website or social media pages or anything like that if people want to connect with you after they listen to this episode?
My daughters have one. I'm computer literate. I can use a computer in the terms of I can write and do stunts and emails and stuff. There's a website there. I think you just put Ricky, I don't know how you get into these things, put Ricky O'Rall in, they'll be able to get into the website and they'll see a lot of stuff that my daughter's put on. I don't do it.
Okay, fantastic. Yeah, I'll look it up and we'll put it in the show notes. We'll put the link in the show notes after this.
I come from a generation that has almost finds computers anathema.
Well, from what I know already, you come from a very interesting generation, so nothing to worry about there.
Okay, thank you.
Well, thanks a lot, Ricky. This has been a fantastic talk. And for those of you who want to read the book, there is, of course, a lot more detail about the Troubles as a whole and about Scappaticci's career and his sordid behavior and everything. So make sure that you pick it up. It's by Ricky O'Rall. It's Steak Knife's Dirty War, the inside story of Scappaticci, the IRA's Nutting Squad, and the British spooks who ran the war. It's a great read. I know that a lot of you are very interested in that period of history, and I strongly encourage you to pick this one up. Thanks again, Ricky. This is a wonderful talk. I really appreciate your time.
And I appreciate it. Enjoyed your crack, Justin. Thank you. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
If you're interested in more of Spycraft 101, look for my page on Instagram at Spycraft101. You can also find more great articles on my website, spycraft101.com. Thank you all for listening, and I hope you'll stick around because there is lots more to come.
Disclaimer. This podcast is for entertainment purposes only. The stories and statements expressed herein are experiences and opinions. They may not reflect the views of the host or the production studio. It's okay if you disagree with our content. No piece of media is right for everyone. If you love Spycraft 101, please check us out online, on Instagram, on YouTube, and especially on Patreon. Thank you for listening.